I'm Kelly Gardner and welcome to Imagining the Past. Imagining the Past is a sneak preview of some of the writers and issues showcased in the 2017 Historical Novel Society Australasia Conference in Melbourne. Born in Jakarta, Indonesia, of French parents, Sophie Masson came to Australia at the age of five. All her life she has lived between Australia and France, and between languages, an experience which has informed a lot of her work. Sophie has published more than 50, yes, 50 novels in Australia and internationally, mostly for young adults and children, but also for adults, including Forest of Dreams, an adult fantasy trilogy based on the life and work of the medieval French writer Marie de France. As well as historical fiction, Sophie has written fantasy, ghost stories, romance, mysteries, thrillers, and a graphic novel, and adapted her novel The Green Prince for the stage. Sophie's books have been shortlisted for many awards, with The Hunt for Ned Kelly winning the Patricia Wrightson Prize for Children's Fiction in the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards. And because she doesn't have enough to do, she's also active in the Australian Society of Authors and is a publisher through Christmas Press. Sophie is appearing at the conference on a panel with one of our other podcast guests, Lucy Treloar, but she's also going to put her publisher hat on for our First Pages pitching competition. Hi, Sophie, and welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Kelly. Thank you.
I wondered, in your role as a publisher, what do you look for in a manuscript?
Well, what we're looking for is, first of all, a sense of a gripping sense of storytelling, something which plunges the reader immediately into the world that the writer is creating. And that's going to be done in a number of ways, of course. There's no one way to write like that. But it is very much a sense of that you're getting of a very living experience. And that also makes you feel, makes you sort of, the characters come into sharp relief. And we also look, obviously, for good, you know, good storytelling skills, and, you know, a nice way of turning words. We also sort of like to be surprised by things, by the unexpected.
Do you know straight away when you read a manuscript? Do you get the kind of, have you ever had that kind of hair standing up on end kind of feeling?
Yes, absolutely, totally. There's some that you know straight away. Straight away, and you think, oh my God, and you're sort of just sitting there gripped. Then there's others that build up more slowly, but that, you know, slowly, and you think, oh, you know, it sort of really just builds up and mounts, and, you know, that can also be very successful. And what I think that possibly is the thing that should be avoided is to have a really cracking start and then you sort of falter. It's better to build up more slowly if you're not confident with, you know, really getting right into it.
Actually, one of the things I noticed that we've all done writing historical fiction is we try and cram a bit too much detail into those first few pages, don't we?
That's right. It's better to let that emerge more naturally later, yeah.
Classic. I've done it myself.
Yes, I think we all have.
So I thought we might talk a little bit about writing historical fiction for kids, because we've both been through the process of researching and writing about the First World War for young readers as
That's part of
the Australia's Great War series. How do you approach creating a sense of the past for kids who are 10 years old or so?
Yes, well, it is difficult, and particularly, as you know, with something like the First World War, which was quite complex, and I wrote 1914, which is really very much about how the world got into this crazy situation. And in order to, you know, give a proper picture of it, you needed to include a lot of things that are quite hard to understand. I mean, some things are, you know, obviously very dramatic, the assassination of the Archduke, etc., but then you have to have all the things that went on around it. So how to do that in a way that was interesting was a challenge from the start, and my response to that was my main character, Louis, is a French-Australian boy whose father is a diplomat, and he's got an older brother called Thomas, and they're on holiday in Sarajevo, actually, when the story starts, but they've been based in Vienna, at the embassy there. And it's really, both of them are very interested in the world already. So Louis is interested in photography, Thomas is interested in writing stories, and so they're going around Bosnia sort of writing stuff, you know, about the countryside and people and so on. And then by, as luck or ill luck would have it, they are actually in Sarajevo on the day that the Archduke is assassinated and actually witness it. And so I did it in a way so that it straight away it starts from these boys are totally impacted by what happens, and they want to know a lot about what's going on because they've actually witnessed this event. And so I was able to do that by including not only discussions that they have with their parents, but also with, you know, sort of mock-ups of newspapers and stuff like that, because that can be a fantastic way of getting across information without info dump, as it were. Mm. So you have the newspaper page, which has all the information on it, but it looks, you know, because it's quite graphic, it's got a photograph and all that, so it you know, it doesn't interfere with the story. So I tend to do that quite a bit, and I did do that quite a bit within the story. And but I also focused on the personal effect that these things have on these young people. So, you know, and Louis actually becomes a reporter, a frontline reporter, and so he actually gets to see a lot of stuff. And I looked up a lot of things about, you know, frontline reporters, both on the Western Front and the Eastern Front. And you know, so he files stories, so which give the reader a lot more information, but which doesn't interfere with the flow of the story once again.
So I guess you also had to decide how to convey the historical truths,
yes,
of war,
yes,
of grief and people being injured or fearful for quite young readers. What sort of decisions did you make about how you would convey that?
Yes, it was difficult because it is a terrible time. And I tried to focus on, you know, these kids have come out of a very multicultural background, and very sort of, they had lots of friends who came from all different things, including from enemies, or what becomes enemy nations. And so I tried to focus it around the friendship thing and how that affects people when they actually have to go to war against each other. And so even though I wasn't graphic about things, I didn't actually shy away from the reality of what happened. And, you know, for instance, you know, when you talk about, obviously, everyone thinks of the First World War, they think of the trenches, but in 1914, it wasn't trenches straight away. It was open warfare across, you know, open ground, except they had these massive machines which just shredded people to bits, and that's why they actually started the trenches in the first place. So, you know, you sort of try and convey that in a way that actually shows the horror of it, but without sort of graphically, you know, leaning on the horrible violence and cruelty of it, even though obviously it has to be there to some extent. And you try to put in sort of certain hopeful things, although it's very difficult in 1914 to actually put anything very hopeful. But, you know, you have to try and do it so that it doesn't become completely overwhelming. Yeah, it's a very difficult balance.
Mm. And I suppose because you got to do the first one in the series,
yeah,
so you also had to capture that sort of sense of innocence. I mean, people just didn't know what the war was going to be like.
That's
they had
right.
no sense of how horrible it was going to get.
No, they didn't, because it really had never happened like that before. And because of these new weaponry, you know, which was the principal reason why it was so terrible, but also the fact was that there had been, you know, sort of little skirmishes and troubles going on all over Europe for decades. There had been confrontations in various parts of the world, especially in the Balkans, but in other parts of the world, and people just thought, oh, you know, it's more of the same. I mean, it's quite interesting to see, you know, when I looked up things, and I got actual copies of actual newspapers from the day after the Archduke was assassinated, and, you know, some of them didn't even put it on the front page. You know, it was like seen as just another of these blooming terrorists making a nuisance of themselves kind of thing. You know, it wasn't seen as, oh, this is something that could trigger this terrible war. So, yes, I mean, and people really thought that they could sort things out, you know. And, of course, they didn't, because there were certain elements that actually wanted to prosecute a war which they thought they could win. Mm. And, of course, that didn't turn out to be the case.
And they've been building up to it for years. I'm interested that your new book, Jack of Spades, is actually set a few years before that, in that
That's
time
right.
of innocence in Paris in 1910. So did your research for the two sort of blend into one another, or is this a completely new idea, new take?
It's a different idea, but it does have, yes, I mean, within the world of 1910 or in Jack of Spades, there are those tensions are there. And, you know, the novel has sort of touches on the what was known as the Nihilist movement, which was an international terrorist movement, basically, which had assassinated presidents and kings and various heads of states all over the world, and that started in Russia in the 1880s, and that had kept going on. And, in fact, the movements in Bosnia and Serbia and so on were nationalist but nihilist as well. So their idea was to assassinate heads of state, you know, which is why they assassinated the Archduke, who was the heir to the throne of Austria-Hungary. And so there's those things there, even though it's, you know, it's the world is not at war, obviously, but there are all these tensions that are going on where, you know, you feel that it could be very dangerous. And in my story, there is an attempt to bring something to a head, which is halted. But of course, you know, things eventually are going to take their course, as it were.
So you get to write about 1910 with the reader having this knowledge of what will happen in the world later.
That's right.
But the characters don't.
That's right, exactly. They think that they've averted a big crisis. And of course, they only had 4 years to go before the next crisis was the one that was unstoppable, you know, sort of thing. So, yeah. So it's a bit, yes, it's a bit, so it's set in a world which is a less dark, but where the clouds are definitely gathering, you know.
Yeah. So how do you find out about how people felt in the past or what they thought about things that were happening? Have you got particular historical resources that you can use to draw?
Yes, I go to France a lot because I'm, you know, a French background. So I have picked up lots and lots and lots of things over the years there, original magazines and newspapers from the time. I think there's nothing like primary source stuff. I read a lot of secondary sources too because they're very useful to give you an overview. But the primary sources, which are the ones where people are actually experiencing it day by day without the benefit of hindsight, actually is much more useful when you're writing a historical novel, because you need to get into the mindset of people who really thought, well, the assassination of the Archduke was just another blip, you know. Of course, there were some people who said, oh, this is going to be really dangerous, etc. So you have different characters expressing different points of view, because there were different points of view. But when you read what is in the actual publications of the time, and you can read some extraordinary stuff, like I read some things, for instance, which were translations of telegrams that were sent between the Tsar of Russia, Nicholas, and his cousin, who was Wilhelm of Germany, the Kaiser. And so, you know, where Nicholas is begging his cousin to please intervene with Austria and to stop them from attacking Serbia and that sort of thing, you know. So it's something that, you know, this wasn't yet written in stone that this would happen. So you're getting the sense of history as it really happened. And, you know, the newspapers and magazines, because they have not only stories about, you know, the war and all that, but stories about ordinary life. So you really get a sense of how people were thinking. I really, really think that the primary sourcing, and it's very, very easy to get them now. Even if you don't travel to Europe, you don't have to do that. You can go to A Books, and if you put in search things for magazines and newspapers of that time, you'll come up with thousands of things, original things that you can buy and use.
Oh, and so much has been digitised too. You don't even have to leave your desk.
Of course.
Don't even have to go to the letterbox.
Absolutely. There's heaps of stuff, yeah. Heaps of stuff. So, I mean, it's good. I mean, the thing is with the old newspapers, not all of them have been digitised. Not all of them have been have got that thing. So you can actually get access to stuff that maybe, you know, is more difficult to find otherwise. But certainly through the internet, there's masses of stuff out there.
So you get all this amazing detail, all this amazing material. How do you decide what to put in and what to leave out?
Yes, that's a good question, because it's difficult. Yeah, it's difficult to know. There's heaps of fascinating things that you learn which you have to cut out, and especially when you're writing for kids, because the story's got to flow properly like a real story. It's not a textbook. You're not sort of, you know, you're trying to entertain them as well. So it has to be where you need a heap of information, because then what you're doing is you're departing from background. It's like you're writing about your own time in that sense where, you know, you just know things about your own time that you don't need to look up. You know, it's just part in the world of, you know, in the atmosphere around you. And you need to feel that about that historical period, because then, in a sense, you will know what to leave out. So, you know, you also, what you're looking at is that if it interferes with the flow of the story, then you need to either ditch it or present it in another form, like a newspaper article, for instance. But you don't want to have too many of them, because, you know, that gets a bit tiresome.
If you're basically building a world, as you do in fantasy, and you've written a lot of fantasy, but it's a world created from historical artifacts and historical documents. So how do you, especially for younger kids who might not have that sense of place, say, or of even what a house might have looked like at that time?
Yes.
How do you furnish that world? What sorts of details do you think are important for the reader?
I think the details that are important for the readers are the ones that are both common to everyone and the ones that are slightly surprising. So, you know, there are things that, I mean, in the past that it's very easy to, the old literary saying is the past is a foreign country, you know. And in a sense, when you go to a foreign country, there are certain things that are very much the same. I mean, people have houses, they have carpets, they have beds, they have chairs, etc. But what else is in the house? You know, what else is going to be different? Is the house made of different materials and so on? So what you're trying to do is to get a sense both of the commonality of the experience and the difference, because you can't skate over the differences. So what I try to do is things that kids are going to relate to in a way. And so, I mean, food is a good example. Always have food in the novels, even in war stories.
Yeah, food's always good.
It is good because, you know, everyone eats. And yet, you know, that it can be a way of conveying something about a particular situation as well. So that, you know, if you're stuck with bread and water in a stone cell, you know, you can conjure that up, whereas if you're eating off a golden plate, you know what I mean? It's very much, it conveys an atmosphere, so, and it's something that everyone can relate to. And then, you know, things like, for instance, the way that people speak, I try to do it so that it feels like people from that time without feeling quaint.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can't speak like they were teenagers in, you know, 2017. But at the same time, they shouldn't be speaking like they're, you know, coming out of a 19th century novel, because that is going to put people off, and especially young readers. So you need to sort of strike a fine balance, conveying, since, for instance, of the politenesses of the past, which are different to now, you convey that without sort of over-emphasising it. Yeah.
So is that about... Because that is one of the tensions for all of us, isn't it? Managing that sense of historical voice with the what we know the reader can hear, read, what's consistent with their own experience, both of what that period might have been like and also what they're used to reading. So is it about Is it about language? Is it about vocabulary? Or is it about tone or some combination of all of those? How do you balance those things out?
Yes, I think it is a combination of all of those things. So my general thing is that most of my characters, my main characters, are curious people. They want to know about things. They are open to experience. They're often quite impulsive, but they come into contact with lots of stuff, you know, because that kind of character is going to be open to things. And so you can convey that, and you can convey, and that sort of person is common at every age. You know, you can read lots and lots of texts that come from different periods of time throughout history where you have that kind of character. And so through a person like that, you can then convey a sense of the particular historical flavour, so that, you know, and I mean, it can be done in the most amazing way. There's, I mean, you know, apart from kids' books, there's a sort of wonderful, wonderful novel called Loris, which is by a Russian novelist called Eugene Vodolashkin, which is a recent novel, which is set in the Middle Ages. And he uses the most amazing combination of very old-sounding, medieval-sounding sort of language and totally modern. It sort of should be jarring, and it's not. It's kind of almost like, this is what the world is like, sort of thing, you know. And so he's captured a tone which is quite unique. Now, I don't do that kind of thing in my books in that way, but I also do try to strike that balance between the language and the tone being both very much something that is accessible to readers now, but that is also truthful to the time in a certain way.
So it has that, that ring of truth, that feel of
truth to it. That's right, yeah. Yeah. And you know the sort of, I mean, you know, I'm sure we've all read the kinds of novels where you read and you think, oh my God, this is like modern people dressed up in medieval fancy dress or something. It's annoying, you know. But at the same time, if it's too inaccessible, it's kind of difficult. In between the two is good.
I remember reading something Hilary Mantel wrote. She says she uses the modern voice but with Tudor rhythms.
Yes, that's a very, very nice way of putting it, yeah.
And I've tried to reread Wolf Hall, listening for the Tudor rhythms, and you can see what she's doing sentence to sentence, but it's very, very sophisticated the way she does it.
It is. I mean, she did that. I mean, I read one of her earlier novels, which is a huge, massive tome called A Place of Greater Safety.
Oh, one of my favourite books.
Yeah, it's amazing, and it does that too. I mean, it really felt like that time, and yet it was also not at all sort of behind a wall of language, you know. It was extraordinary.
And that, I mean, that's another good example of, you know, it's set in the French Revolution. We know what's going to happen. We've got this terrible sense of foreboding. Yeah. If you know anything about those people in real life, you know what happened to them. And it's that incredible urgency
that
she captures.
That's right, because you really feel that, you know, there's still a chance that things might turn out better than they did, you know, sort of thing. It's like, it is a really interesting way to do it. And I must say, I was incredibly heartened when I was told, because one of my earlier novels, The Hunt for Ned Kelly, won the Premier's Award for, you know, literature for young people. And one of the judges told me when he was reading it, he said, even though I knew exactly what was going to happen to Ned, I was still hoping and wishing it wasn't there, because the tension was there, you know, and that was really exactly what I'd hoped for. So it was really nice to hear it. And, you know, it doesn't always work, but when it does, it's really, really great.
Maybe this time Ned Kelly will escape.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
That's perfect. You need to get that printed out and framed.
Yeah.
I wondered too, just about some practical things. You're working with all this material. How do you actually manage materials? Do you go to the places that you're researching? Do you take notes? Do photos? Do you end up with lots and lots of manila folders of newspaper clippings? How do you juggle all those resources?
Yes, I do all those things. I go to places, I take photos, I make lots of notes, I read a lot of stuff online, I buy books, I buy newspapers and magazines from the time. And then I sort of try and identify a trail, a main trail, through all this massive jungle of information. And I then, you know, identify little side paths that may be entered, not too far, but, you know, so it is a thing. Over the years, I guess I've learnt to really organise it quite well. I don't have a specific sort of organisational framework, if you know what I mean. I just pile up all the stuff, and I know fairly early what the main core of the thing will be, so that it, then you tend to concentrate on those things that have to do with it. I do love the research, so it's difficult to sometimes to just think, I can't use that. But, you know, quite often things have come up in one particular book that I think, oh, you know, later on. And later on I did do something with it, you know. So it is something that, you know, no research is ever wasted, basically. But to basically manage it, I think you've really got to have a good idea of what your main focus is going to be.
I think many people who write historical fiction just love the research as much as the writing, don't they?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it can be hard to stop, can't it?
But it's a joy as well.
It is, yeah.
So have you got any last tips for people who might be pitching to you at the conference, or indeed to any publisher?
I think that what you need to convey is a sense of passion, but a sense of clear passion, if that makes sense. That is, that you are passionate about what you're writing about, but that you're also clear in your own mind about what you're writing about. You know, sometimes people can have a great idea, but they're a bit fuzzy around the edges. It needs to be quite clear, because remember, people can't read your mind. And whilst you may see the architecture of your work in your mind, the other person is not got access to that. So you need to be able to convey that, but at the same time to convey it in a way which does show your passion. I think that is probably the most important thing for me.
Okay, the clear passion.
A clear passion.
For that very specific project. Now, we should say that at the conference, some of the extracts from the pitched manuscripts are read out by somebody. Yeah. They're actually narrated by somebody. And I remember at the first conference, people who had pitched heard their words back to them for the first time. And sometimes they could hear them and they thought, oh, my goodness, I have to fix all this stuff. Now I hear it in somebody else's voice.
Yes, that's
I see
right.
what I have to fix. And then there was one that the whole room went, ah, that's the one.
Yeah.
And that was indeed the one.
Yes, yeah, that's right. It's true. That is a really good way of putting it, because, you know, what you have to think about is that as a writer you have to communicate to other people. So when you hear it in someone else's voice, you're hearing it more objectively than you would if you're hearing it in your own head. And especially in a room full of people who are not related to you.
Yes.
because that's helpful, you know. So it's the objective thing, you know. I mean, it is so for every art form. I mean, I remember my youngest son, who's a musician and stuff, and, you know, I love his music, and I said lots of good things about it, but he said, you know, Mum, you're my mum, of course you're going to say nice things. But, you know, well, the funny thing was that when other people said exactly the same thing to him, he related to it in a different way, because it just feels like you hear it in another voice which is not related to yours. So.
Yeah, objectivity is a good thing. And
absolutely.
Listening to it read from the stage over a microphone in front of a whole lot of other people is...
That's right.
It looked like a very sobering experience for all concerned.
Yes, I'm sure. And because it is actually your words, so that's the other thing. It's not just somebody else's view of it. It's actually your own words, but that you're hearing back at you, which, is an interesting thing to experience.
Well, we look forward to that. We look forward to talking to you more at the conference. So thank you so much, Sophie, and we'll see you in September.
Thank you so much, Kelly. I look forward to it.
Thanks for listening to Imagining the Past. It's a sneak preview of some of the writers and issues showcased in this year's conference of the Historical Novel Society of Australasia. In Melbourne, from the 8th to the 10th of September, the conference will explore ideas around identity and writing in historical fiction. There'll be interviews, practical workshops, debates, and academic panels. You'll hear from the likes of Kerry Greenwood, Arnold Zabel, Kate Forsyth, and Melissa Ashley. And our podcast guests, including Deborah Challenor, Lucy Trelaw, Sophie Masson, Zulara Gentile, and Robert Gott. And me, I'm Kelly Gardner. You can find out more or buy tickets online from hnsa.org.au.